tweede avond van Talk of the Town, waarbij drie directeuren, tevens programmeurs van drie min of meer bekende internationale kunstcentra, komen vertellen over hun activiteiten. Vorige week was hier Jérôme Sans, directeur, samen met Nicolas Bourriaud van het Palais de Tokyo in Parijs. Vanavond Lynn Cook, curator en de enige van het Dia Arts Foundation in New York. En volgende week, dinsdag, komt Charles Ash, directeur van het Roseum in Malmö, een stad in Zweden die 20 minuten van Kopenhagen ligt. Deze avonden zijn er voor om de noodzakelijke feitelijke informatie te verschaffen over concepten en formules voor kunsthallen, voor kunstcentra en musea, die de laatste tijd mede door de discussie rond het Stedelijk Museum in debatten en krantenkolommen verschijnen. Omdat wij hier zo makkelijk en direct contact hebben met onze collega's en ook zelf benieuwd zijn naar hun ervaringen, willen wij onszelf en u graag laten inspireren door hun. Sommige van die instellingen zijn van recente datum, andere functioneren al veel langer, maar steeds zijn zij spraakmakend. De formule van de avonden, voor het geval u er nog niet bent geweest, is als volgt. Eerst presenteert de persoon in kwestie zijn of haar instelling. Daarna komen er steeds twee kenners vanuit verschillende achtergronden aan het woord en stellen elk 10 minuten lang vragen aan de spreker. Een beetje een televisieachtig format zonder samenvattingen, want daar schatten wij u een beetje te hoog voor in. De vragenstellers van vanavond, maar hopelijk hoort u daar zelf ook toe, zijn achtereenvolgens Fleur Giebe, bestuurslid van de Appel en waarnemend directeur van Kunst en Meerwaarde, een instelling die sponsoring voor de kunsten stimuleert. De tweede ondervrager is Ole Bouwman, hoofdredacteur van Argis, die zelf ook een aantal grote tentoonstellingen heeft georganiseerd. Vanavond gaat het over DIA, een instelling met een lange geschiedenis als ondersteuner van kunstenaars die vaak commercieel weinig support in Amerika kregen, maar die later zo machtig is geworden dat men over vormen van promotie ging spreken. Sinds 1987 heeft zich een enorme wijziging voorgedaan met de vestiging van het zeer studieuze en publiek georiënteerde DIA Center for the Arts aan West 22nd Street in Chelsea, waar Lynn Cook sinds 1991 als de enige curator de scepter zwaait. Rond dit instituut dat niet verzamelt, maar waar tentoonstellingen soms wel 3 jaar lang staan, al worden die perioden steeds doorsneden door andere presentaties met andere tijdsbalken, is de hele wijk Chelsea ontstaan met honderden galerieën die met elkaar de positie en de rol hebben ingenomen die Soho ooit had. Daar komt nog bij dat DIA nieuwe plannen heeft, een heel nieuw museum aan de Hudson dat in 2003 opent en waar wel plaats is voor een collectie, mogelijk ook voor al die ephemere en tijdelijke installaties die in de loop van de afgelopen 15 jaar in Chelsea zijn getoond. Mag ik uw aandacht voor Lynn Cook, curator van DIA for the Arts, iemand die daarnaast nog heel veel andere tentoonstellingen heeft gemaakt, zoals de Biennale van Sydney, die destijds ook de Talk of the Town was in Australië en ook was zij onlangs betrokken als curator bij Forward 2001 in Brussel, een presentatie van werken in de openbare ruimte. Lynn?
Thank you, Saskia. Saskia's asked me to talk about the program at DIA and I will try and sketch it in about 40-45 minutes and then I'd be happy to take questions or to engage in some kind of debate. I don't know how many of you know the institution firsthand, but I thought I would set it in context and try and give you some idea not only of the actual programs that go on in terms of exhibitions, but some indication of why we do the programs that we do do. Okay. So DIA has had several name changes. It's just gone back to DIA Art Foundation, but essentially for 10 years it's been DIA Center for the Arts, and it became what in the American context is called a not-for-profit, which means it's not run by the state, but it isn't private either. It's this in-between category. But before this happened in 1987, it had been a truly private foundation in that it was founded by two people, a German gallerist, whose name is Heiner Friedrich, and an American heiress of the Schlumberger family, Philippa de Menil. And for 10 to 12 years, they collected in a very personal and, you might say, idiosyncratic way, in that they were interested in certain contemporary artists and making projects happen which wouldn't otherwise perhaps have taken place. one of the works, characteristic works, that they brought into being was what's called the New York Earth Room of Walter de Maria's, which has been open to the public in Soho since the late 70s and is there more or less on permanent view. That and this, another piece by Walter de Maria called The Lightning Field, which is in a very remote part of the desert in New Mexico, was also a project that they realized. And over this 10 to 12 year period, they worked with about 12 artists on these vast projects, all by assembling large quantities of work in the case of artists like Twombly or Warhol, who didn't work in situ on the land, or another project in Europe. There were several European projects too, so Walter de Maria's vertical kilometre in Castle, where the kilometre goes down into the ground to the depth of a kilometre literally, was funded by them, as was Voice of 7,000 Oaks. So they had this wide-ranging attitude to promoting and realising extraordinary projects, but they weren't at all interested in making what would be known as a survey collection, a collection which looked historically at a certain period. This meant that over this period of time, they focused on about 12 artists, all of them German or American, all of them male, and all who'd emerged to kind of critical awareness or international prominence in the 60s. So by the early 80s, this meant they were working with a list of Donald Judd, Dan Flavin, John Chamberlain, Warhol, Twombly, Boyce, Imi Knoebel, Palermo, Fred Sandbach, and Walter de Maria. When DIA became a not-for-profit, it changed its format completely, and yet at the same time it took over the collection. So the land art works like this and ongoing land art projects, which DIA's got re-involved with, including the Terrell's Roden Crater and Michael Heiser's City Project, are still part of DIA's collection and its day-to-day activity. But at the same time, this building was bought. It's a four-story warehouse dating from the turn of the century, and it's in Chelsea on West 22nd Street. And at the time it was bought, this was an area that had no art spaces in it. It was a part of the city that was where taxis are refurbished, where there's warehousing, but no art at all. But the reason that the property was bought in part was that it was relatively cheap compared with prices in Soho. It was good in terms of the kind of building. It's very flexible with a fairly wide column structure in it. And the program was to be set up that in such a way that the focus on individual artists in a concentrated way would be maintained, even though the founders were no longer part of this and there was a full board in place. And the way this translated was to make a program that would be one floor, one artist, one year. So there are four floors. It meant that each artist would be offered roughly 700 square meters, and the project that he or she realized would be on view for 9 months to 15 months, depending on the cycle. At the same time, the Boyce 7,000 Oaks project, which had been funded by DIA, was continued along the street and now runs all the way down the street. As a consequence of DIA moving there and of real estate properties in the city going up enormously and the rise of the fashion industry and various other factors, in the past 6 or 7 years, many galleries have moved into this area, so that from having no neighbours who had anything to do with contemporary art or the visual arts at all, there are now maybe 120, 150 galleries in a 10-block spread. And Soho has died, and the East Village have died essentially as art areas, and almost all the gallerists have moved around, which has had an enormous impact on the institution. Firstly, in terms of the kind of audience it brings. DIA has never spent money advertising its exhibitions. It's not really productive or effective in that with an exhibition program that's highly specialized to do wide and what would be expensive advertising in newspapers or magazines brings in people who are not, in a sense, prepared for such a concentrated view of fairly cutting-edge work, and they don't find access easy. Whereas, for example, when an institution like the Museum of Modern Art with a 20th century collection and a range of familiar work like, say, Picasso or Matisse or whatever, puts a very contemporary show in, the public, I think, finds different ways into that. It doesn't so easily in a place like DIA. So from our experience, it's not worth financially and ideologically, I suppose, worth advertising. And what we're looking for is not a one-off viewer, but an audience which comes back again and again. So we do listings in fairly regular channels where all other institutions list their current shows. We have a website and access, like information is put out in those ways, but not to attract a kind of loose, undifferentiated audience. Nonetheless, when I started in the beginning of the 90s, there was an audience of about 20,000 people. Now, given the context of many, many galleries, it's up to something like 80,000. And that's had an impact in terms of very practical matters like circulation of people through the building, which is much less easy to move people through than was the case formerly, and you'll see why in a minute. And it's also had some impact, not explicitly, but I think subconsciously, for artists on the kind of work they choose to show, knowing how many people are going to walk through it. There are a number of pieces in the building which are permanent pieces, most of which started off as commissions with no end point, and at some time they seemed so effective and to work so well that they were subsequently acquired and became permanent. Such is the case with this Dan Graham two-way mirror glass pavilion, which provides fantastic views across the city onto the river, and a site for events like poetry readings and dance and so on. And there's a video cafe as well, which is part of the same project. At the same time as the focus for the changing exhibitions remains in Chelsea, other works have been added to the collection, mostly through gift, occasionally through acquisition. There's not an acquisitions budget as such, so if a work is pinpointed, it's then up to the director and the staff and the board to find money to acquire it. At one point, we acquired several works by Robert Smithson, and the estate gave the spiral jetty to DIA, which now maintains it. And it recently, after a long gap, reappeared and was visible. The problem when Smithson made it was that his information was incorrect and the water level of the lake was unnaturally low, so he built it to a certain height and then found immediately that it would be submerged much of its life, which is in fact the case. And we're faced with the question of whether to restore it and change the height of the jetty, which was what he proposed to do, but died before it could be done. And so now I'll show you some of the exhibitions and talk about what kinds of exhibitions we make and why. The building was converted by Richard Gluckman, who's worked on a lot of art spaces, including the Warhol Museum, in 87. And the conversion was meant to be fairly low cost and to maintain the fairly raw character of the spaces. There's one exception, which is the fourth floor, which has minimal air circulation. There's no air conditioning on the other floors, which means immediately that we cannot get museum loans were we to want them for exhibitions. But given that there's a very long viewing period, it means not only that people coming to the city, many professionals in the art world probably come once a year and therefore manage to see the shows, but it means that for local people there's the possibility of repeated viewing. And one of the first shows that took place after I arrived was the project of showing Gerhard Richter's Atlas, which is now well known to most people, but at the time had not been shown for many years and had never been seen in North America. And this is a project, as you probably know, that whereby Richter continually updates this archive of photographs, both found photographs and photographs he takes himself of images for his paintings or around as possible sources for paintings. So there are thousands of photographs in this work, which has subsequently entered a public collection. And this was put on view as an opportunity for people to come back again and again to look at a work which is absolutely at the core of his practice. I'm sorry, this is on its slide. Aside. But you can see from this something of the character of the space. The floors are concrete, the ceilings exposed, and all these walls are temporary. So that for every exhibition, walls are built in place as needed. So in addition to choosing works by older artists who are of the same generation as those in the collection, in other words, the contemporaries of Boyce, Judd, Flave, and so on, such as Richter or Lawrence Wiener or Onkawara, we also make exhibitions of younger generations, but not of emerging artists. The argument being that 7,700 square metres, 7,000 square feet, is a lot of space for an emerging artist, and that there are other institutions whose mandate is to focus on that, and we would do better to look at generations of artists who have already established their voices, who have built a body of work and a practice, so that with an invitation to make a new project, they are well-seasoned or experienced. And given, too, that the space is quite raw, and you see it better in this slide, this is an installation that Anne Hamilton made in 1993, and you can see that the whole field, or just about the whole of the floor, is exposed here. So you're looking north, and that's the east wall of the building behind the columns on the right-hand side, and the west wall is just here. So she pulled the whole thing back and then made this project that involved sewing a pelt, a giant horsehair landscape, and at the same time having a person in the space for the 9 months that the show is on view constantly, where this person was seated at a table with a hot wire, and what they did was they removed the text, obliterated the text from books, as you could see here. And the project is about a tension set up between the kind of bodily-based knowledge one has through one's somatic corporeal responses to the world and acquired information and our perhaps over-dependence on that those forms of information and knowledge, and a reorientation back towards a more instinctive, more physically, phenomenologically grounded forms of knowledge. In order to do this, obviously it's a big undertaking by an institution. It has been Anne Hamilton's practice to, in a sense, test the institution within the kind of concept. And so this piece took daily monitoring, in that the horsehair had to be raked every morning, and a very elaborate schedule of volunteers set up to come and always be present, burning the books and going through these rituals. The way in which the invitation went out was quite typical, in that I'd followed her work for some years and thought she would be someone who would work well in this kind of space, as indeed was the case. And so the artist is invited to come and look at all the floors and then make several site visits if necessary, and then choose a floor. Floors are essentially the same in terms of their footprint, but different in terms of the amount of natural light. It gets more as you go up the building. And as I said, on the fourth floor, there's some air conditioning. There's also skylights, so it's a differently tailored space. And depending on how that fits their schedule and the other exhibitions already on the schedule, the project is then undertaken. And this can mean it takes 2 years to realize the project, or 9 years in some of the longest cases. And it's a matter of juggling as the proposals come in and they get worked through, and trying to make sure that, for example, there are not four video installations simultaneously, or there are not four German artists at once. So there's some variety and continuity and diversity within the building at any point. Commissioning is a big part of it, and in the early 90s, when, in my view, the kind of much of the cutting edge of our younger or middle generation artistic practice was centered around installation, that tended to be the way the exhibitions were realized. So there were projects by Jessica Stockholder, Robert Gerber, and Juan Munoz, and Hamilton, and of the slightly older artists, Robert Owen made this. It's a very difficult piece to photograph, but it's a series of cubic spaces made by scrims with fluorescent lights which have been wrapped in gels, and each cubic space is of a slightly different color because the gels on the tubes are different, and it's a labyrinthine structure but on a grid, and given that the light is also changing through the windows day and night, it was subtly different constantly. It was Owen is an artist in his early 70s now. He is highly regarded. He's now well known for the Getty Garden. But he'd not made a large-scale installation, which is at the core of his practice, for maybe 10 years in New York, and was really not known to many to many of our audience. And that was part of the reason for commissioning this. The piece was enormously effective and enormously interesting to people who came back again and again. And we ultimately kept it up 2 years, partly just because of the constant interest and engagement of people in it. And then finally it was acquired for the collection, which is a complicated thing in that it's truly site-specific and can only be put in that space. So, and it will have, it's not a simple thing to reinstall it. So it's another kind of commitment, and depends on that building remaining as part of Deere's holdings. And as I said, it's a multi-site institution. It's not just with these land art projects, but you'll see later there's another museum outside the city that's about to open. And I show you briefly another large-scale installation, this time by Hanna Darboven, called Kulturgeschichte, Cultural History, 1883, which is one of the most encompassing and encyclopedic pieces that Darboven has done. Again, she was an artist who had not had a large-scale museum show in the US. This piece seemed a particularly suitable one because it's enormously elaborate, but it also reprises many works in her career, and it's both a good introduction to the range of her interests, and it really rewards repeated viewing. This was on view for a year approximately, and again entered the collection. But entered the collection, as did the Owen, several years later when money had been raised for it. And About 4 years ago, we acquired a second building on the same street, literally across the street from the exhibition space that we've been looking at. And this is a one-story garage. And the beauty of it is, in part, that it has no windows, but it has excellent top light, and it has no columns. So it's about 25 metres by 25 metres and a clear span. And it meant that we could therefore show certain kinds of work that we couldn't show in the other building, either because we physically couldn't get it in or because of the column structures. And the cycle of programs here went in the same way, either running to a year with one artist and beginning either in the spring or the fall. Building shut in the summer because it's extremely hot and uncomfortable, both to work in it and to be in it. And also because since our audience is a self-selecting, informed audience, there are very, very few people coming to New York to look at art in the height of the summer. The season dies, and it's not cost-effective or practical to have the building open in July and August. But it's very useful to have it shut to be able to do extensive maintenance on the building and to prepare shows, to build walls and build the infrastructure for specific exhibitions. This cycle of shows in this building began with large pieces by Richard Serra called The Talked Ellipses, which you may know or you may have seen reproduced, which we could never figure out a way to make an exhibition with Richard Serra in the other building. We couldn't get the work in. And this body of work was so large that he couldn't show it elsewhere at the time. And subsequently, we showed Panamarenko's Era Modeler, again, an artist well known here in Europe and probably very well known to you here. But someone who was not known in the US and who had not shown significantly ever in museums. And the decision was made to take this piece, which is amongst his best known, partly because it's such a landmark piece within his own history and within the history of the 60s and 70s, rather than commissioning new work. So there are a variety of ways of approaching working with an artist, depending on their history, on what seems appropriate to the audiences and to the context in which the work will be shown. And artists like Darbov and Panamarenko would not, and probably still would not, be shown by institutions on the East Coast. And that's not true of Richter, but the Atlas, again, was not shown in the recent Richter retrospective. So the program is complemented by what's going on in the city. It's determined by his own institutional history and, as I've indicated briefly, by the nature of the building, that this kind of raw space is unlike that of the major museums like the Guggenheim Museum of Modern Art or the Whitney, in that it's not tailored white cubes, or doesn't have to be, and therefore the kinds of work they show very well, particularly painting shows, we tend to not to do, except in occasional circumstances, and instead to capitalise on the flexibility of the space and its raw character, which means that a lot can be done with it. And just to demonstrate that, I'll show you this work by Juan Muñoz. We ended up building a street inside one of the floors, and so this whole thing is a simulation of a street whose qualities and properties, the concrete exterior, the types of doors and windows and whatever, were taken from the vernacular architecture around it. And as you walked onto the floor, you walked into a street, and then it opened up into a series of rooms in which you found kind of tableau of different works that Muñoz had made purposefully for this exhibition. He's not primarily an installation artist, so it was a combination of responding to an invitation to try and contextualize the work in some kind of ensemble rather than simply a series of self-contained sculptures. And at the same time, not pushing him to take his practice in areas that wouldn't he didn't feel comfortable going. So these works could then be taken out and subsequently shown in other contexts and disassembled and sold. That would not be the case, for example, with the Ann Hamilton, which didn't exist after the show closed. It's another room in the Munoz. Another. And as you walk through this labyrinthine space, it was virtually impossible, even for people who knew the building very well, to orientate themselves or find their way through the space. It was completely, completely transformed. It's the detail of the mouth of one of the figures that was speaking. And I show you this to indicate we very rarely tour shows with site-specific installations. By definition, they more or less, they really can't travel, and that would be the case with the Owen or the Hamilton. This was site-sensitive, I suppose. It was very closely related to the site, but it could be adapted. And working together, Juan Munoz and I took the show to Santa Fe, which has a similarly raw industrial space, and it was remade there with slightly different architecture that was derived, again, from the immediate vernacular surroundings and reconfigured with some of the same pieces and some different ones. That's the last part of the Santa Fe show, or variant. And I'll show you just a couple of slides from Thomas Schutter exhibition. Schutter was, again, an artist who's well known here and had been seen, his work being closely followed and very visible over a 10-year period. By the time we came to plan a show, he's also a very prolific artist and he works in a wide variety of media and ways. And he did not want to do an installation. That's not what he does. And after mulling it over for some time, he was sure he didn't want to do that. And proposed that I come up with some schema for making an exhibition. And it's not possible to do a retrospective in this kind of amount of space, or to do a retrospective that I thought would do him justice. And it seemed very that it would be very arbitrary simply to select a body of work or new work or something like that. So eventually we came up with an idea that we would make a three-part show that would really run for 2 years or slightly more than 2 years. And it would be based around three themes that seemed to run through his work. So essentially we made three shows where we changed them time after time so that people who were able to follow it over a long period of time saw a great deal of Schutter's work, nothing that was ever meant to be comprehensive, but saw trajectories running through it that gave them different ways of accessing it. So I'm showing you just a couple of shots from these three different parts. This is one of the first works he made, I think, while still a student in Düsseldorf with Gerhard Richter. And it's a series of 400 or so little paintings which look like bricks. And they were installed to form a kind of brick dado in one of the galleries that looked directly out onto brick buildings beyond. And these are the models from Westkunst. And then there were more the Piazza, you know. And then a series that ran through monuments and memorials and ending up with, in the third year, or second year and third part, recent work. He'd made these over the course of the exhibition for the final presentation. And from these, the first in these series of monumental bronze female figures were presented. And then a couple of instances of more recent exhibitions. As it seems that focus of interest for younger and mid-career artists has moved away from the kind of very materially based installations like the Gober or the Hamilton or even the Munoz. In more recent years, we've seen a lot of video-based film-based installation projection. And in selecting artists, in following what artists are doing, and it is artist-led, or the programming at least is artist-led, I was very concerned to choose artists who would, I thought, who actually had an understanding of the spaces and simply didn't turn the lights off and turn the projectors on, and who would therefore be attuned in some way to the experience of coming to the space as well as being able to address the space with an installation. And I think Diana Fait is particularly engaged with these kinds of questions. Her work is never in a black box. It's always in it's sufficiently lit naturally or supplemented with artificial light in such a way that your experience is hinging between your understanding and engagement of the real place and space, counterpointing that with the illusory world that the projections are setting up. And this piece she made for this site, which is a piece around the based on a notion of mapping six-dimensional space, which is a complex mathematical theoretical proposition, which she happened upon, and which was theorized in relation to the dance of the honeybees. So that what you see when you come into this space, the piece is still there, are six hexagonal projections which skew across. There's the door in the back left, skew across the space, up into the onto the walls, into the ceiling, and they change in different cycles. You see bees moving through different kinds of spaces. But you can see from this too, this is not artificially lit. This is sort of the degree of light levels, how you're there's a whole cast of magenta light down one end that draws you over into other parts of the space where there are not projections, and you move backwards and forwards in relation to the architectural conditions as much as to what the projections are doing. This is not just, I think, particular to what's possible with projections. It's not so different from some of Tiepolo's wall ceiling paintings, and he works with the actual architecture and the illusory architecture and how one flows into the other. As I said at the beginning, the advent of so many other galleries has changed the neighbourhood and changed the audience, or expanded the audience. It became evident to us some couple of years ago that we could, you know, it was difficult for people to circulate in the building. The lobby was too small. People ended up lining up on the street to buy tickets when it was busy. There wasn't a bookstore, and there wasn't a good bookstore in Chelsea, and there was not adequate co-check, things like that. And so we started to think about renovating the lobby, expanding, taking the workshop out of the ground floor, putting it in a bookstore, and there was also an exhibition space on that floor. And in a way, it's been Dia's practice to work with artists as architects in some sense, following perhaps the model of Judd at Marfa, where the Chinati Foundation, which was a Dia project, was set up, where Judd bought a military barracks and subsequently many other buildings in this remote town in West Texas in order to put his own work and those of some of his colleagues on view. And Judd's ideas about transforming warehouse spaces and industrial spaces were really at the beginning point, and I would argue enormously influential on the way in which such spaces have been transformed for presentation of contemporary art since the 60s onwards. And certainly Judd's ideas were very influential on Richard Gluckman, who was the architect who converted the building in 1987. So having said that, we thought of, again, approaching an artist to make this conversion and not looking backwards to an older artist, but to do this, follow the model, and therefore to work with a younger artist, and eventually decided to ask Jorge Pardo. And Pardo immediately said that he didn't want to treat the lobby the bookstore and the exhibition that he could have in the gallery space as different things, that they were all one and that there would be no hierarchy between them as he saw it. And so what he did, the first step he made was to propose putting this tiled floor through all three spaces and running the tiles up the columns. And then, as you can see here, we're standing at the entrance to the gallery space, looking across into the bookstore, past an alto wardrobe, which is that kind of grey thing, just through the first panes of glass. So that they're porous and permeable one to the other. This is looking from the back of the bookstore back into the back of the gallery, and the first exhibition ended up being the presentation of the Volkswagen Beetle model, which you see there, plus the Alto wardrobe. And what you can see from this shot is that there's a mural on the wall in the gallery. There's a corresponding mural above the bookcase in to the left here in the bookstore. So the whole is framed as one entity. And at the present, inextricable one from the other. All the furniture was either chosen by Pardo or designed by Pardo, as were the ticket desks and all that. We're looking now in the opposite direction at the book shelves and the mural there. So it's one work, it's a project. And when we did it, initially we thought that we would probably transform the gallery back into a more conventional space and retain the bookstore and the lobby. In fact, and we didn't know how long we would keep them for. There was no idea, firstly, how well it would work, and secondly, whether we would want to live with it, whether it really would be functional after a while. It's turned out to be enormously effective, both as a great place to work and be the light, because it's bouncing from the ceiling off the tiles, the efflorescence of colour. It's just a terrific place to hang out in. The bookstore's big enough that people meet and spend time there. It's not simply a commercial outlet. There are readings and launches and book launches and poetry readings and other events that take place there very regularly. And other artists said that they thought Pardo's imprimatur in the gallery space was not so heavy that it wouldn't be possible for them to work in it. So we've kept it as it is, and it's now in its third year. And we've made changing exhibitions in the gallery space in different ways. The lights are Pardo lamps that you see in the bookstore manager's office. And from doing this together, he and I, the subsequent year, Gilberto Zorio's sound piece from 1969 was installed, and Pardo responded with a big moving curtain. And currently there's a body of Gerhard Richter glass sculptures and mirrors and things in the space, which transform it thoroughly. And there'll be another dialogue or intervention next year. There's the Alto wardrobe, which isn't literally the one from Judd's collection, but Judd collected 20th century modernist furniture. And in planning this project with Pardo, we took him to Marfa to look at Judd and work there and to just think about the history of the institution. And one of the reasons for including the Alto was both it's a kind of stylistic forefather, or his work and his ideas are for Pardo, but it references also the kind of pivotal role that Judd has played. As I said, we don't tend to do painting shows. Other institutions do them very well. There have been reasons in recent years to do a couple of them, and I'll show you very quickly reference to three. And these began really because, in the case of each artist, it seemed they were enormously overlooked and their work was very timely in terms of thinking and reassessing it in the light of what younger artists were doing. And Bridget Riley was a case in point. So a Riley show was made 3 years ago, you see some examples, and the way we did it was to put very early works, kind of classic Riley artworks, and commission from her a wall drawing, which you see here, which was made for the site. And again, it wasn't a retrospective. We left out 20 years in the middle, but to bring together some of the early work, which is the work she's best known for, and the work that younger artists like Jim Lambie and many others, or Philip Taff, have looked to, and also look to what she was doing at the present, but in relation to a site and a context which is more Dear's own history. And so that was the kind of pairing. So you started with late work, you walked through into early work, and then you saw this, and then retraced your steps through it. You can see how it both links to her early work and depends on viewpoints that are angled viewpoints, entry points in and out through different doorways into the space. The second in this, in what's become not really a series by default, I suppose, was Alfred Jensen, who may not be known to you, but was very well known in the 70s into the early 80s. He's an artist born in Guatemala who started painting only when he was in his early 50s, having had a career as a traveler, patron. And so is exactly the same age as Rothko, but when you look at the work, it looks much closer, say, to Alhald or Stella, who were the people who were showing, emerging at the same time. And yet the kind of theories behind this, their elaborate cosmologies based on ancient calendrical systems from China or Egypt or Mayan cultures, but woven into this geometric abstraction. These paintings hadn't been seen for a long time, and again, it seemed interesting to bring them back into view. So the Jensen show followed Riley, and there were odd connections. Judd wrote one of the first reviews of Jensen shows when Judd was writing as well as painting in glowing terms, and maintained a lively interest in each other's work. And most recently, an artist who's very familiar to you, there's currently a show of Jo Baer's work. And again, she's an artist who in the States was very well known in the 60s and 70s. There was a retrospective at the Whitney in 1975. At that time, she left the country. She's never lived in North America again. She stopped making abstraction at that point. These paintings, these are graph paintings from 62, and then the series, the kinds of work you know well. These, again, for a younger generation, are completely invisible and unknown. And the decision was made to focus on the works that she made in her years of living in New York between 1960 and 75, partly because that work seems very pertinent again, partly because it's work that parallels the work in the collection, and partly because it's fantastic work. And so that show is on view now at the theatre. And finally, I'll just briefly outline the latest project. As I said, Dia's got a collection which is rarely able to be shown, and only in very small increments. It's been the institution's wish to put that collection on view for a long time. In 1990, a building was bought on the same street again, on West 22nd Street, in anticipation of converting that and putting some of the collection on long-term view there. In the end, there was no money to do that at the time, and as time went on, began to seem a less viable proposition. One reason being that to get really good space for these large-scale works, it was obvious we could get better space if we went outside Manhattan, which is very expensive. And given that the collection was going to be on very long-term view, it isn't necessary that people have instant access to it if they're only going to come back once a year, or in the way one does with a collection, say like the Frick, which is a collection that's pretty much static, but is something one wants to see again regularly, but not daily or weekly. So we began to look outside the city, thinking that people, if it was within reasonable access of the city, people would come. And eventually we found this building. This is a former printing warehouse for Nabisco Biscuits. They used to make biscuits in Chelsea, just down the street from us, and then the boxes would be printed here and taken by rail down, the biscuits put in them. And the great thing about this building is, although it's a warehouse, you're looking at it down there, it was built in 1929. So it was built principally with one floor. It's a horizontal building, not a vertical stack, as is the case with so many of these converted industrial buildings. And that because they were using it for printing, they wanted to do it as economically as possible, and therefore to use daylight rather than artificial light, and have very good daylight, which printers need. And so, as you can see, all that white area is skylight, north-facing skylight. And then the back part is a third building, which has clear stories, a different kind of roofing structure, but again, top light. And then the part nearer the river here is the railway siding, where the trains would come in to offload and load the boxes. This is right on the river, Hudson River, and it's right on the rail line. The train station for this town, which is called Beacon, is just off the side of the picture. So you can take a train from Grand Central Station in Manhattan to Beacon. It takes you 1 hour and 10 minutes. It's a 4-minute walk from the building. So it's very easy. The trains go every hour. In effect, you can easily go up and back in the morning if you want to. And so we hope that this means that people will come regularly and easily. The conversion is minimal. The desire was, again, not to change the building radically, but to work with the artists who are still alive to choose spaces in the building that they thought would be suitable for their work. And in the case of those who are not alive, the director and I have worked to design spaces for, in terms of dimensions and light quality, for those particular works of art. And the overall transformation has been undertaken by an artist, not an architect, although there are project architects, as there must be by law. The artist is Robert Owen, who has had experience working on the team for MoCA in Los Angeles and in San Diego. And he's designed indoor and worked with us both indoors and outdoors. What you're looking at here is a view along the west towards the train shed where Richard Serra decided he wanted his sculptures to be. This wasteland will be a garden that Owen has designed. This is a mock-up of the front of the building as you drive in. The car park has turned into a grove of flowering crab apples and cherry trees. And the only part that's been built is a small entranceway, which is kind of dead ahead. The building, as I said, was built in 1929, just before the stock market crash. It was to be Nabisco's headquarters, and they were planning 5 more buildings. They didn't build any more after that. It means that they had drawn up the plans to extend buildings this way, which is north, and on the other side, so those facades were never finished. The east and west facades were finished, so they're landmarked and can't be changed. So there was scope for us to build on the north-south axis and add in the way we couldn't from the east and west, and that partly affected the orientation and the fact you come through the car park. And this is the building before it was transformed. renovated. The columns are on a grid of 18 feet, like 5.5 meters by 40 by 30 meters. So they're quite far apart and quite flexible. The ceiling heights are about 5 meters. That's looking down the side of that same building. And that's a work by the German artist who lives in America called Vera Luther, who makes pinhole camera images. And she took that of the main floor before work was done on the building. And I'll stop there. That, I hope, gives you some idea of how the program's made, what kinds of shows are done, how the institution works, and some of the reasons for why it's taken the form it has. Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn. Fleur, would you like to start doing the questions? Later on, after Fleur and Ole Bauman have been asking their questions, there is a public microphone. Please use it later on. It's now here, and it will be with you.
Yes, I'm very impressed by the building and by everything that's done there. But I'm also impressed that you're just the only curator. So, I'm not an art historian or anything at all. So I would like to know a little bit more about how your organization works. Because I just had a look at your website and I saw enormous amount of staff people. And but I also saw an enormous amount of trustees and founders and arts councils. So I wonder how many people are working on this whole financial part? Because, you know, if you're the only curator and there's so many people, I mean, I don't know how many people are working there.
It's actually a very small staff. By institutional standards, it's tiny. When you look at lists, we list all the guards, the janitors, okay, everyone. So it's, you know, everyone's name is present.
Still, I mean, you're the only curator. And how many people are working on this whole, well, funding and friends and the whole financial?
There's nobody who deals with membership and friends. Strictly. Somebody's part of their job. There's one person dealing with the website where we commission works, but also with all the technology, all the computers, all of that. There's one person and an assistant working with public relations. There's a part-time education person. There are a couple of people in finance and administration. There's a board secretary who also does members and things like that. I have an assistant, the director, the assistant director.
But I guess the director is spending a lot of time on this whole.
He spends a great deal of time on fundraising and on orchestrating the different and handling the overview, given that there's the Lightning Field, there's Bridgehampton, where the Dan Flavin institution is. There are staff in different places. Overseeing this conversion.
Okay. Well, but you know, if I look at until you had this transformation from private funding to this how do you call it,
not for profit.
There were only 12 artists that you were collecting. To what extent do the trustees or the founder have an influence on the selection of the artists, or is it just completely just an independent thing?
The board is responsible for the institution financially and legally.
The board are people who are also
individuals who are nominated and who are on the board for 3 years, and then that can be repeated.
And they also pay a lot of money to it, or not?
They don't. No, they donate money,
okay,
and of varying amounts. There are some who have. The chair of the board is very involved with this Beacon project and has given a huge amount of money to that personally.
Yeah.
There are other board members who, relatively speaking, have given very, very much less.
Okay.
So it's not that you buy a seat on the board. It varies with different institutions, and the amounts that people give are different. There's also fundraising from other individuals. We get almost no corporate support. We're too small.
Yeah,
they don't find us, you know, we're not prominent.
Yeah, no.
And our program is too narrow for corporate support. Mm. So there are traditionally three sources of revenue. One is from the board and fundraising. One is from a dinner, one of these gala dinners that takes place once a year, which raises a considerable amount of money. And the third is, as in most American institutions, from an endowment, from investments.
Okay. Well, you know, it's more that it's just such a big difference from here. Yet last night I was at a meeting at one of our big banks, and there was also some about funding of museums, and someone told about the American experience, and they also said that all these trustees are all linked with being friend or whatever. And I guess that's the main difference here, because I don't think in Holland you would ever think of that. So I just wanted to know. But another thing I was curious is that, well, mostly you have these long-term exhibitions, or whatever you call them, you know, of 9 months or even 3 years. Does it also have to do with the fact that there's so many galleries around it, so that there's already so much to see in Chelsea that's also for you more...
No, because this program of one artist, one floor,
yeah,
one year
anyway.
Happened long before the galleries arrived,
yeah.
And really had to do with the idea of focusing intensely on an artist, making a considerable commitment,
yeah.
And that commitment on both sides, both in terms of what the artist puts into realizing project on that scale, is met in some way by being able to keep it up for a long time.
Mm.
As I calculated, if you take the same amount of space in a museum, a normal museum would probably program 5 shows in the course of a year.
Mm.
If you add all those budgets together, it's probably not much different,
mm.
really. And in fact, you have no downtime.
Mm.
I mean, piece stays up, so it's simply a different model.
Yeah.
But it's not that having galleries around it made it possible. Having a big city with other institutions made it possible.
Yeah.
If we were the only contemporary art or modern art museum in the city, if we were in Cincinnati, you couldn't do this.
No.
But because there are other institutions and other galleries with very visible programs, it's possible to do something like this.
Wow, it's great. And maybe as a last question, maybe you could also give us some ideas. If you were to set up a museum for the 21st century, what would it look like?
Well,
it's more 60s, 70s, 80s maybe.
I think that one looks at key historical moments, and that I would argue somewhere between 1907, 1912, 13 were absolutely, that was a turning point in the history of Western art, and that 1965 to 75, loosely speaking, was another absolute turning point. And I think, as I read it, much of what's done today has its roots in the late 60s and early 70s. And the fact the century changed doesn't seem to me really of fundamental importance in looking at the history of art. What is important is the legacies from the late 60s on, which is not to say that every museum has to start there if it's a contemporary museum, but I don't see that making cut-off point at the beginning of the 21st century makes any sense necessarily. I mean, you could make a cut-off point at 1990.
Yeah. Well, you know, it also has to do with the present discussion here at the State Museum, you know, whether or not they should just concentrate on, let's say, the 20th century and then make another building somewhere else which is more oriented on the 21st century. Some people say you can't just split it, other people say, well, you can, like Palais de Tokyo or whatever.
Yes, but the Palais de Tokyo is not a museum.
No,
it's Kunsthalle.
Yeah.
And I think there's an enormous difference between an institution with a collection and how it divides, like Tate Modern, Tate Britain. That's a very peculiar... I mean, on the one hand, yes, the British legacy, it means they collect British art in a depth they can't collect anything else. But then in the post-60s world, especially when the art world became far more international than previously, or British artists were part of that international world, it creates a ghetto in Tate Britain. In when you look at the work of the late 60s and 70s, where they have all this conceptual work, but it's only British, it's a nonsense.
Okay.
And it's very awkward for living artists who find themselves sometimes in Tate Modern, sometimes Tate Britain, or the Whitney, which makes less and less sense over time and maybe arguably should stop at a certain point, simply because American art was fairly insular and provincial, it should be said, up to the late 50s. And then you can't tell the story of American art from the late 50s onwards without reference to things going on.
Yeah, right.
So I think these are very problematic questions.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe Ola wants to go more deeply into...
Thank you very much. Just to give you a very quick view on my background to make it more understandable where my questions will come from. I spent part of my time as curator, and the other part is mainly devoted to editing an architecture journal, but not focusing on architecture as a pure profession, addressing problems of clients, but more like going with architecture on an exploration or an expedition through culture and test the discipline of architecture as a cultural medium with regards to these different issues, cultural issues. So it's more like asking the question of architecture tomorrow, what is its mandate, how could it be defined, is it still architecture as construction or building, or is it maybe just an art practice dealing with space at large and things like that. So it's more like questioning than trying to promote and present a certain canon, as most architectural journals do. You know, let's say the top 200 architects, the top 200 buildings, and that's it. That's more or less the main practice of architectural publishing. And what I'm doing every day in a way is curating another story of architecture. And this is heavily relating to your presentation, because, and that's my first question, when you present your work and the description of your background and your institution and the artist you are presenting, it's very much a presentation of a certain canon, the way a canon, the canonical works.
Oh.
So in terms of the monographical approach, the time people may spend to see a work and see it again and see it again, and the slow digestion of works and the acknowledgement and the respect you can pay to the work and things like that. So it is about the canon. It is about building up a certain prominence to very specific positions in 20th century history of art. Is this a very conscious attempt to build up a 20th century or second half of the 20th century history of art?
Well, it's two-pronged. The collection is one thing, and what goes into the collection is different from what gets exhibited. Although, as I said in the case of, say, the Hanadabo, it went from being exhibited into the collection. The focus was recently sharply defined for the collection. More artists will be added, but only artists who are of the generation of the 60s and 70s. There's no acquisitions budget. There's no money annually to buy work. And the work is very particular We don't have one Rosenquist painting, one Vasarely, one. We don't have anything like that. We can never make a survey or an historical overview, which is what many museums strive to do. But we have a lot of these monumental installation types of work, plus the in situ land art pieces. So the decision was taken by the board that if they were to raise money to acquire additional work, it would be by other artists of that generation, and that it would be far too arbitrary to go and start buying from a younger generation. I mean, what if we bought one Douglas Gordon? I mean, how can you place that in a context with this? To take just one example. And so in the last couple of years, a body of work by Agnes Martin has been added. But it's a whole gallery. It's one work in many parts. One Agnes Martin paintings of... We don't have the capability to deal with that. But subsequently, we've been given more Agnes Martin paintings and we've acquired others. So we've built up a body of, a considerable holding of her work, which can be presented in a gallery devoted to her work alongside the Richter, the Darboven, and whatever. So it's collecting within a framework. It's not making a canon. Hopefully what it would do is give you an in-depth presentation of a selective range of some of what took place in the 60s and 70s. Or more recent work by the same artist, but emerged out of that particular melting pot. In terms of choosing artists for the program, it's done in a completely different way, in that the younger end of it is not made with a view to linking into the collection. It's made with a view to what would work well in that space, what isn't known and available, that seems important, what can we allow, encourage, make possible for an artist. We obviously don't do a show of an artist who's also going to do a show at a nearby institution. There are too many good artists to be doubling up in that way. But at the same time, I wouldn't argue that these are the 20 best artists of the late 20th century. And one doesn't think in those terms. One thinks of what this situation encourages.
No, but in contrast to what is happening in culture at large, but also in the recent history of contemporary art, one sees an incredible siege to the basic categories of representation, the reputations of the authors, the work as a thing. There is a strong discussion about going away from the object-oriented piece of art, but also in terms of reception. The participation that might be produced or brought up by a curator to bridge the gap between the work and the reception and things like that. So there is a recent frenzy about rephrasing and redefining the basic categories by which contemporary art works. So then back to your presentation. So leave apart what's actually happening in the space, because I know on the ground level, especially sometimes the feeling that I can have there is not just paying respect, but it's really exchange between ideas, people, artworks, and people, etc., etc. But in terms of your presentation, it occurs to me it's incredibly coherent, and it's coherent for more than a decade already, and it has been coherent even before your. For the moment you took up that position. So how do you manage to stay so coherent?
Well, I personally would say that institutions need to figure out what their role is, and to, in figuring that out, to find a path and really work at that. And they don't all have to be doing the same thing. And the more you can figure out what you can do well, and the more you can build on that, maybe the more coherent it gets, but at least it makes an argument which people can grapple with, disagree with, at least have a position because there inevitably will be many others, and it's for me more interesting to have a position than to do a bit of everything. I don't find that of any interest. On the other hand, I'd also say that yes, there are different audiences, there are different art forms. I'm not a big fan of computers in galleries. I think there may be interesting website work, and we were amongst the first institutions to commission work specifically for the web, which is a very different medium and accessed differently, I think, either at home or through libraries or wherever. You don't need to be sitting in a gallery to look at a computer. So that work goes on in parallel with the physical programming in Chelsea. There are other kinds of activities. There is a whole ancillary program of lectures, debates, readings, book launches, and whatever, which I didn't talk about. I tend to like still and think it important to look at works in a sustained way. And there are other types of experience that other institutions are doing. One doesn't have to do bits of everything.
But do you have the ambition to generalize your approach? Would you recommend this approach to? Do you position it in our present cultural practice as a very important stance to take, and that your work is one of these rare examples in which concentration and duration and these kind of qualities are still highly appreciated?
It's not a model. I wouldn't propose it as a model for any other institute. I mean, I don't think people should take this as a recipe, no. I would say that I do think trying to figure out what one's doing, be clear about it, be analytical about it, and committed to it, seems to me, yeah, I defend that. And
it works. The more you protect such an approach, the more it will work as a model in a way. If concentration is such an important value, you know, and if you can, if you succeed in maintaining that value for such a long period of time, then it starts to work as a model, isn't it?
No, because it could also prove to be irrelevant. I mean, it could
of
be.
Of course, but that's always possible. It is a subjective position that you as a curator takes, and then. If it is more and more in contrast to what's happening around you or what is happening among many institutions and related to the discussions that are going on about the future of the museum, and I don't think it's just an issue that's at stake here in Holland, it becomes this very strong position of an institution with you as the chief curator promoting it. After all, it works like that. So maybe it's not your starting point or your attention, but the effect of it.
But
it might be.
One way or another, all institutions have a vision or a focus, and they promote what they do. So this is one amongst many, for a start. It isn't, and it's one that grows out of a set of circumstances and historical contingencies. And can capitalize on its physical, geographical location as well as its past history. There are also other types of institutions whose brief is to do things very rapidly with enormous turnover, with a kind of gargantuan appetite that takes in everything, that mixes it all up, and leaves it to their audience to figure it out. That's one type of experience, but in that, if you take literature, there's many different categories, from science fiction to high literature to romantic historical novels and so on. We know those categories, and when we feel like a book of a certain type, we choose one, not another, and those canonical categories have been established for a long, long time. Seems to me the visual arts world hasn't really figured itself out quite so clearly, but you could begin hypothetically to think about categories like that, and some institutions deal with a certain type of work, others deal with another, and if you're in the mood for one type of experience, you go to one. If you're looking for something else, you go to another. And depending on what you're wanting, you sort it out. They don't all have to offer all of it.
Well, maybe it's my experience that if I read the text, if I go to exhibitions, if I see the big discussion, if I follow the big debate on the future of the museum, if I reflect on all kinds of options that are brought forward by different very important curators, and then if I go to New York and I go through the city, which is all about flux and which is all about updating and exchanging, and the ephemeral is valued very highly, and then finally I come to Chelsea and I come to Dia and I see this program and I see works that I've seen a year ago already, then for me, and I think for many people, it is a statement. It is a very strong statement that in the heart of Chelsea there is this institution and it does this and it believes in it, you know.
But I don't have trouble looking at a work of art more than once.
Of course, but I'm now referring to what's actually happening, you know.
But
and then if
the fact that some of that is happening doesn't make it irrelevant to have other works where one wants to look at them again and again, whether they're in the same place or not.
What I try to figure out is how do you reflect on that world around you in choosing for the permanence? You know, you see what I mean?
It's choosing for a longer consideration. When you say permanence, collections in any institution, unless the institution deaccessions, which is very unwise and problematic, collections are permanent. If you're talking about long-term programming or rapid turnover of exhibitions, I just think they're choices, and one doesn't preclude or exclude the other. And even if we're living in an image-saturated world of increasing turnover, it doesn't mean there aren't some things we like to do more than once or contemplate.
But even in the world of collections, where curators are fond of the collection and love the collection and could never give up the collection, in either private or public collections, there is this growing uneasiness about what is the legitimacy of this collection. So the natural relation between the historical values and the aesthetical values that at some point in history were the reason to buy something, this seems to be threatened, you know. So there are quite a few. Maybe in here in Holland it's a stronger discussion than in the U.S. But there is this growing disgruntlement about the collection. What is the legitimacy of that collection? Why do we have this piece here in our house? That kind of question.
And what is the legitimacy of such a long 10 minutes? Thank you. So, no, I'm not taking over. I just want to know if there's an unease in the audience because they haven't been able to put any questions in themselves. It was fascinating to listen to this canon. Is there anybody who would like? Yes.
I'm very interested in this idea of the canon and the idea of flux being a very ever-present and current conversation. And it seems to me that there's a new canon which is about a fetish of production or a fetish of constantly seeing things, or that there's a rhetoric of what museums and all art spaces actually so predictably do, which is constantly show new, rapidly. And there's a huge relief, actually, in hearing about a very focused direction of potentially revisiting something as well and offering a different space. If anything, I think the canon is to constantly, currently show the new. And I think that's why somewhere like Dia is so important.
Do you think that the whole of Chelsea is now going to move down to the Hudson River in like a couple of years?
No, because what's happened this time is that in Soho, most of the galleries rented their spaces. Bigger, more established galleries in Chelsea bought their spaces. I don't think they're going anywhere.
Right. There was another question. When I go to New York, I sometimes go to the Walter Maria, the golden bars, and then you see a girl sitting behind that table, and I always wonder, is that like a life job for these people? Like, you know, one day you get that job and you do it till you retire.
If I tell you she's married to the man who looks after the earth room, will that
right.
make it feel more like a family affair?
Maybe something about which you could explain about the relationship of the sort of semi-permanent longer during installations and the collection that's going to be presented at Beacon. Is there any relation in a sense that if you've invested so much time, energy and quality in an installation, in what way could you tell or ask the artist to say, could we recreate this piece? Are we allowed to? Or how much, what sort of contracts do you have? And are they very different? I mean,
some pieces will have to change for conservation reasons. The dab oven, for example, is on paper. It can't stay up all the time, so it will have to be rotated. The Richard Serra talked ellipses are unlikely to go anywhere just because at 20 or 40 tons each, it's impossible. It's just not likely that they will be moved. Other pieces, other spaces will change, maybe in 5 years or whatever. But
I mean, also the more recent pieces, like the Pardo. Would you be able to recreate that at Beacon one day or never?
No, never. Once it ends, it'll be gone forever. There will be one changing space at Beacon annually, which is we have a gigantic basement and we don't have a lot of work that needs dark spaces. It's a dark space, and there will be one exhibition made a year, which hopefully will mean that people will want to come and see it, which means they'll come back once a year, and I think that's probably realistic, it's obviously an aspiration too, that people might come once a year in the way that many people go to Schaffhausen once, twice. Schaffhausen changes less, or the Krex collection there changes less. But with a collection that's in place, partly, and I spend a lot of my life in London, with paintings in the National Gallery being in the same place year after year, and I was happy they're in the same place. If I wanted to see them, I would go and see a particular one. You could go and see whatever you felt you wanted to see or needed to see or rethink. And you didn't have to go and look at the whole thing each time. And if the works were important works, they were always there. There was some peripheral change. And that seems to me a fairly sound basis for a collection, provided and that one would use Chelsea and the changing program as a way of keeping the collection alive and relevant. And other practices, you know, what's going on elsewhere does too, but the two can enliven each other, and it seems to me important. You couldn't switch their roles. There would be no point making a series of changing exhibitions in the country and having a static collection in New York.
You can draw from it.
You can draw around, yes, and you can move it between. But Chelsea, in a way, that program hopefully can also make you think about the work upstate and maybe revisit it in order to see something else from the period, like Robert Whitman in Chelsea.
Last question for me. Oh, there's one here. Last question for me. When is it opening, Beacon?
May 16th, 17th, 18th.
May? 2000, next
May. Yeah.
I was recently engaged in a very strange conversation that could very, very radically stand in contrast to what I see or understand as your beliefs, mm-hmm. because you kind of work with very strong individual positions of artists. The conversation I referred to was about the opinion of somebody whom I really respect as well, saying that the most recent history of art has not been produced by individual artistic positions, mm-hmm. but by exhibitions, mm-hmm. projects that in most cases taken outside the institutional framework and smaller or mid-scale institutions. Mm-hmm. And actually, in one of the conversations also the role of a museum, or how should museums position their acquisition strategies toward this kind of development. I know we discussed at back in Utrecht that Boymans van Beuningen acquired the archive of Museum of Progress for as an example of dealing with the most recent history of art. I wonder what your opinion about this kind of radical statement is, that it's not individual artists who produce art history most recently, but exhibitions as collective statements of artists or individual statements of curators.
I think maybe collectives, some collectives are certainly producing important work, and we're not committed to individuals to the exclusion of a collective. It would be quite possible to work with a collective. I think exhibitions contribute to the history of art, whether it's Harold Zeman's 1972 documenta or whatever. I don't think an exhibition is a work that is... it's a different thing, and I don't think curators are artists. There are artists who curate, but curators curating are not surrogate artists, in my opinion. I think that a lot of work has been done outside institutions, particularly in the 70s, really through to the last years. On the whole, I think that, well, two things. One, that there are now artists whose complete career is in the public sector, and public art, at least in North America, is a thing unto itself, with curators who specialize in that area, a whole infrastructure and artists who work in that way, and it has its own dynamic and its languages. There are obviously artists who occasionally work in other places. I think that most of the artists who are working in institutions may do an occasional public project. It's becoming increasingly difficult in North America for legal reasons. It's incredibly tied up and slow and difficult now. That I hear many artists say that it's just not worth it. And by the time they get through all the bureaucracy and all the... it's mostly they're backing off it. And then there's many smaller hit-and-run operations or things in interstitial spaces, which are, contribute in other ways. They don't need a big institution to manage them. In fact, we're not helpful to them. And this is only one sector of the art world. So, yes, I think that I'd agree with part of that. But I don't think institutions have become irrelevant. But I don't think they're the one and only, nor the most important, in the same way that there's no one centre to the art world any longer. There's no one type of institution, nor is everything institutionalised, although I would say it's increasingly difficult to get outside that.
There's a question here.
What I thought was interesting that you, in your talk, reflect, well, most of it is contemporary, but you reflect three times on really, well, ancient art. Cepelo, you mentioned the Frick Collection, and you mentioned the National Gallery. Is there something linked with your institution and these old institutions, or is it just, I thought it was interesting you said something, and I wondered whether there were links between your institutions and those that you mentioned.
There are no formal links at all.
Okay.
I happen to like going and looking at art from other periods and also think about how institutions worked and the history of institutions and institutional history, what types of museums were formed at different historical moments and why, and how they've evolved or not, and what the pressures and constituencies and ideologies surrounding them, simply because I think it's part of being a curator attached to an institution to know something about the larger playing field, both historically and geographically.
Okay.
Any other questions? Otherwise, we're going to continue. Thank you
very much.
Wonderful talk. Please join us.
great advice.